A heavy metal mission. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. NASA is launching a spacecraft to visit a metal-rich asteroid called Psyche that could help explain the formation of our own planet. It's a curious asteroid made of nickel and iron, not rock and ice like many other asteroids. We'll speak with NASA's Lori Glaze about what questions this mission might answer. Then UFOs are moving from the fringes to the front page as more organizations like NASA and the Department of Defense take unidentified anomalous phenomenon more seriously. How is it shaping the conversation about sightings? We'll speak with science journalist Sarah Scholes about the reaction from the UAP community. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Later this week, NASA is launching a spacecraft from Kennedy Space Center on a mission to visit a curious metal-rich asteroid that could help explain the formation of our own planet. Lori Leshin is the director of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. At a press conference last month, she explained why scientists are so excited about this mission.
Psyche is a mission of firsts. The first journey ever to a metal asteroid that could reveal clues about planetary cores and how planets form and evolve early in our solar system.
This mission to the asteroid Psyche will launch on SpaceX's Falcon Heavy rocket as early as this Thursday and will arrive in 2029. Here to talk more about the asteroid and robotic explorer of the same name is a different Lori, Lori Glaze, director of NASA's Planetary Science Division. Lori, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Very exciting time to be chatting with you on the show. We've got both Psyche, the asteroid, and Psyche, the spacecraft. Let's start at the asteroid first. Why is this such an intriguing and curious asteroid?
The thing that I find most interesting about the Psyche asteroid is that, you know, we know there are millions of asteroids out in our solar system, and we know they occur in different places out there. But out of those millions of asteroids, so far, we've only detected 9 of those asteroids that we think are, you know, mostly or have a significant amount of metal on their surfaces, so iron and nickel. So Psyche is the largest of those 9, and it has this, you know, when we look at it from Earth, it looks like it is a metallic structure. And so that's just fascinating. It's just truly unique.
What are most asteroids made out of? It's like rock and ice, right?
Yeah, so most asteroids are made of rock and ice. Yeah, good point. They're made of rock and ice. We have some of those in the rocky category that are kind of high in carbon, which is of interest when we're thinking about, well, how did life come about on Earth or maybe other places in the solar system? Was there carbon or carbon molecules that were delivered through those asteroids? But an asteroid like Psyche, while it may have some of those rocky materials, like I said, it really looks like it has a lot more metal on its surface than some of the rocky asteroids.
And you mentioned we know that it's made of nickel and iron. How is that? How have planetary scientists made those observations from Earth?
Yeah, so we have a couple of different ways that we can use to estimate what we think an asteroid is made of, because they're far enough away that they're really kind of hard to see. But we get a couple of pixels back and that sort of thing, and so we can get reflection off of it. This object's about 140 miles across, so we can get a little bit of reflection information off of it that tells us about how reflective it is. We can point our instruments at the asteroid and get some what we call spectral signature, kind of tells you how it reflects at different wavelengths. And then we can also kind of get a sense from how it moves around and how it responds to other things, other bodies in the solar system, on how dense it is and things like that. So we've got a couple of different indicators that tell us what we think it's made of.
And obviously getting there with a spacecraft is going to get you a lot more data. We'll talk about that in a moment. But what questions do you have now as a planetary scientist before you get to Psyche about this curious asteroid? And what do you hope this mission will answer?
Well, because it's so unique, we've never seen one of these kind of asteroids up close, we know it's going to be a mission of discovery. We're going to see things that we probably don't expect. But one of the hypotheses that I think is the coolest that we're going to try and test with this mission is that, you know, our planets, like Earth and Mars and Venus, we have metal cores, you know, primarily iron and nickel metal cores that are very dense. And so those form when a planet is forming and all the materials coalescing together. There's heat on the inside and it kind of melts the material and all the heavy stuff goes to the center, forms those cores. The lighter material, the rocky stuff, goes out on the outer part of the planet. So one of the ideas is maybe the Psyche asteroid was one of these early, what we call planetesimal, like a baby planet. And then it got hit by some other big object that would have blown off all the light crustal material and just left that metallic core exposed. And how cool would that be to see up close at the interior of a planet? Because we don't really have any way to do that. We can't see Earth's interior, you know, even Mars and Venus and Mercury. We can't see their cores either. But how amazing would that be?
Because it would probably be a bad day if we could see the interior of the Earth, right? We don't want that.
We're not. We don't really want to be there. Yeah.
So getting up close with this this metal core, what will that help us understand about our own planet itself?
Right. So being able to see the interior, to see the core of what may have been an early planetesimal is going to help us really get up close information about what the composition looks like. What are the physical properties of this thing? If it actually turns out to be something we think could be a metallic core, you know, what does that look like? What did these early planetesimals, what were they like? So I think we'll get a lot of amazing information about how planets form, about what happens to them, you know, when they, I was talking about the interiors getting hot and melted. You know, how do those processes work? And we'll get a lot of like good details about the what that interior core is made of and how potentially it formed and got to be how it is.
And do you have a good sense of the rarity of a type of asteroid like this? Is it, have you surveyed most of the main belt asteroids and this is it, or of the asteroids that you've surveyed, this is a rare one?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, you know, we've sent we humans, right, between NASA and the European Space Agency and Japanese Space Agency, we've sent missions out to go look at a variety of asteroids up front. Most of those have been these kind of rocky or icy bodies or, you know, carbon-rich asteroids. But really, we've only taken a very, very small sample of all of the millions of asteroids that are out there. And this Psyche asteroid, you know, 9 out of, you know, several million, this is extremely rare as far as we can tell from what we can detect with our sensors from Earth.
Let's talk about the Psyche, the spacecraft now. Tell us about the robot that you are launching from this planet to get to this curious asteroid. What's it like?
Yeah, so we are launching a satellite also called Psyche, and the spacecraft is interesting from a variety of perspectives. It's going to be powered by electric propulsion, which is kind of an interesting technology that actually gives them a kind of flexibility in their trajectory, how they'll get out there to Psyche. They're going to launch from Earth here, hopefully on the 12th. And then they're going to do a flyby of Mars to get a little gravity assist. And then they'll swing on out into the main asteroid belt eventually, and they'll rendezvous with Psyche out in 2029. Once they rendezvous, they'll stay there at Psyche for a couple of years and map out the asteroid. They won't come back to Earth. They'll stay there out there at Psyche. But they're carrying a bunch of instruments, special instruments that'll help us get more information about what Psyche's made of and what it's like. They're going to carry a magnetometer, you know, it's a metallic asteroid. We'd be interested to know what kind of metallic or what kind of magnetic signals we might see. Search for any kind of ancient magnetic fields that can give us information about whether it was a core of a planet or not. We're going to carry a gamma ray and neutron spectrometer. And why those are interesting is that they kind of measure the emissions, gamma ray emissions from the molecules that are contained in in the materials at the surface of Psyche. And so that'll tell us what kind of minerals are present, what kind of elements are present, you know, is it really iron and nickel, and what else is really there? And then we've got, of course, cameras. Cameras that'll give us lots of great images. We plan to share those images with the world almost immediately as soon as they come down to Earth. So we all get to discover what Psyche looks like together.
It'll spend a limited amount of time orbiting the asteroid. I think you said 2 years, right?
About 26 months, yeah.
Is that a limitation of the hardware? And follow up, is it going somewhere else after Psyche?
It's a great question. So when we consider missions that we're going to fly, particularly this kind of mission that's led by a scientist, this one led by Dr. Lindy Elkins-Tanton out at Arizona State University, you know, she developed her idea and she came in with a proposal and she said, look, in order to achieve the science that I want to do, and she laid out the science rationale and she says, it's going to take us 26 months to do the science that we've proposed to do. And we make a selection and we say, that's our baseline that we're going to fund and we're going to fly that mission. And there's no plan to go anyplace else afterward, but we do have a process in NASA where the team can come back and say, look, we're still collecting fantastic data here. The spacecraft is still operating really well. Would you let us go and continue to take more observations in an extended mission? And so there is that possibility that they could come back and propose for an extended mission. And I'm sure if the science is valuable, we'll keep going.
Finally, Lori, I can't help but notice this kind of, asteroid fever or asteroid renaissance that's happening. We've got the sample return from OSIRIS-REx. We've had other missions to Hayabusa. Like, can you just reflect on this particular moment that we are in, learning about these asteroids, and what it's really going to help in shaping our understanding of our solar system and our place in this universe?
Asteroids are, you know, the remnants, right? They're the leftover pieces that built up the planets and the moons in our solar system. So that's why we find them so fascinating, is that each different type of asteroid can tell us a different part of the story about how our planets formed, how the solar system was formed. And so that's why we have such an interest in these different asteroids. We find different composition of asteroids. Psyche is a metallic one. The asteroid Bennu, visited by OSIRIS-REx, was very carbon rich. The asteroid visited by the Japanese Hayabusa 2 mission was more rocky rich, less carbon present. And so each of these can tell us different things. And we also find them in different parts of the solar system. So the asteroid that OSIRIS-REx went to, Bennu, is a near-Earth asteroid. So that means it flies by Earth periodically. It's in the inner part of the solar system. Psyche is in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. We have a mission called Lucy going to some special asteroids that are called Trojans, and they are in an orbit that leads and trails Jupiter in its orbit around the sun. And each of those different populations and each of the different compositions give us different pieces of information about how our solar system was formed. So they each are providing a different piece to the puzzle.
Lori Glaze is the director of NASA's Planetary Science Division. Lori, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
It's been quite a time for asteroid science. The OSIRIS-REx spacecraft delivered a capsule filled with dust from the asteroid Bennu. We spoke with one mission scientist about the process of analyzing this cosmic dirt. We'll link to that on our website, wmfe.org/arewetherayet. And if you've got a story or segment idea for the show, well, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email with your question, topic, or guest you'd like us to cover. We're at arewetherayet@wmfe.org, and we'll give you some credit on the air for the idea. Still to come, UFOs, from the fringes to the front page.
There is a group of people within the UFO community who is very happy that, you know, there are official sources and official organizations really paying attention to this topic, taking it seriously, investigating it scientifically.
A new chapter in talking about UFOs. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. For years, talk of UFOs and alien visitors were on the fringe. But now, as the Department of Defense and NASA are publicly acknowledging the existence of Unidentified Anomalous Phenomenon, or UAP, the conversation has gone mainstream. Sarah Scholes is a science journalist who has reported on the search for alien life and the community surrounding UFOs and UAPs. Her most recent book is They Are Already Here, UFO Culture and Why We See Saucers. Sarah, the last time we talked, the Department of Defense was about to release its UAP study, and NASA just announced that it was getting ready to jump into studying this phenomenon as well. But a lot has changed since then. From your reporting and, you know, the way you know this community, what's been the reaction by the UFO and UAP community to these recent events?
Yeah, I think the reaction has been a little bit mixed, like any good reaction, probably. There is a group of people within the UFO community who is very happy just that, you know, there are official sources and official organizations really paying attention to this topic, taking it seriously, investigating it scientifically, and, you know, being transparent about what they're finding, you know, holding public meetings, even the Department of Defense and also, of course, NASA. And so I think, yeah, there's a lot of people who just feel like here's a topic that I've been very interested in. And now, you know, very legitimate people are paying attention and maybe we'll get some answers. And then I think there is also probably a smaller reaction of people who say, you know, both the Department of Defense and NASA have said, you know, what we have found so far indicates no evidence that UAP have anything to do with aliens. And, you know, there's always the reaction of, well, you know, of course they would say that. Why would they give away the greatest secret in the universe? So a little bit of conspiracy going on there. But I think by and large, people are just happy to have others paying attention.
Let's take a step back. What was the reason NASA got involved in this? And what has been kind of the blueprint moving forward? And what have they learned? What have they told us that they've learned?
I'm not in the rooms where they officially make the decisions about how and why to do something, but I think that NASA officials thought that the space agency would have something to contribute to this. You know, they gather tons of data from satellites and other sensors looking down through the atmosphere on Earth, or just, you know, on Earth. And, you know, they are a public agency that works largely on unclassified things. And so they thought, you know, maybe we have some data that could help this out. And so that is kind of the framework for the NASA UAP study, is like, let's spend this time. Let's look at the data that we have. Let's look at the analysis methods that we have and see what we as a scientific agency, not a defense agency, might have to contribute to this project. And so that, you know, they haven't, as I understand it, done a ton of actual analysis on the data so far, but more just looked at what could we be doing if we were focused on doing some kind of UAP research.
When we spoke last, we talked about these stories hitting mainstream media outlets. We talked about the New York Times piece on the Tic Tac and how it was bringing a topic that has generally been in the fringes to the mainstream. You know, in these 2 years, has the public perception of UFOs or UAPs or whatever term we're using, has it changed the public perspective or the stigma around talking about the topic?
I think that the stigma around the topic has changed, at least in terms of talking about unidentified things in the sky without any, you know, connotation of what they are. Like, I think if you ask most people, they would agree with both NASA and the Pentagon that there are things that people see that we have not identified, which is, you know, the straight up definition of a UFO or a UAP. And so I think that the stigma around saying, like, yeah, I saw something, I didn't know what it was, I'm a military pilot or a commercial pilot or just a person in my backyard, I think that has become pretty well accepted and nobody's going to think you're, you know, off the wall for saying that. I think that there still is some stigma and, you know, probably rightly so, to saying, like, I know that means there's alien spaceships on Earth. And I think in some ways, you know, having these official organizations very officially investigate UFOs has made people less likely to associate UFOs with aliens and just to say, you know, there is stuff up there, we can't explain it, let's investigate it, rather than I saw something, the little green men are coming to get me.
You know, there are robotic missions on the surface of Mars looking for ancient signs of life. We have the JWST Space Telescope that's searching for signs of life on other planets that exist outside of our own solar system. You know, that quote-unquote little green men finding, you know, could be in the realm of possibilities in both of our lifetimes. I mean, is that sentiment changing with what's happening on the scientific side of things?
Yeah, I think it has been slowly evolving, actually, for a number of decades. You know, the idea of searching for life in the universe in general has really come into the mainstream, like you said, for distant exoplanets and for planets in our solar system. And that's, like, usually one of the main goals of most of NASA's really expensive, sophisticated instruments. And that's not controversial at all. Everyone agrees that that's a cool and interesting thing that we should be doing. And I think even for the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, you know, not looking for microbes on Mars or chemicals in the atmosphere of a distant planet, but actual signals from a potential civilization far away, you know, that used to have a large stigma attached to it, which SETI scientists used to call a giggle factor, that I think has decreased as we've learned more about the universe and how big it is and how many planets there are. And, you know, the UFO alien combo side of things is kind of the last vestige maybe of that stigma that exists. And so I don't know that I know what will happen, but we have seen this kind of mainstreaming of the rest of it. And so it would make sense to me if it kind of continued in that direction.
There's also, you know, and I've heard from a few people, including people in my own newsroom, about a fear of what we may find, you know, this kind of existential crisis that we may not be alone out there. I mean, do you think there's enough being done to address these genuine concerns of fear and anxiety of unknown?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, one way to address fear and anxiety of the unknown is to make it known. So in that way, things like the NASA study are could potentially help your colleagues. I think a lot of people would say it's scarier to think of a universe without any other life. Like, there's this whole thing, billions of light years wide, expanding all the time, and it's just empty and we're the only ones. Like, that's a lot of pressure, I think. But I think, you know, yeah, as we start to have more of these conversations about, you know, what life might exist in the universe, is it out there? Is it here? Then it's important to have those, you know, maybe less hard scientific and more sociological and psychological and cultural conversations about what it means. And kind of an aside, if I may, is I am always amazed by the number of people who, when a story comes out that says, like, hey, maybe we discovered something that has to do with extraterrestrial life, they're like, well, yeah, duh, no big deal, and then just kind of move on, because they already think that that's true. And so it's just kind of further confirmation. And I'm like, no, wait, let's take a step back.
I do want to take a step back, and I recognize that this answer may not be able to be answered in the short time that we have here, because you actually wrote an entire book on it. The book is They Are Already Here, UFO Culture and Why We See Saucers. Sarah, what is this fascination with UFO culture and interest in this group that the book takes a fascinating look at? Can you just tease our listeners with what you found?
Yeah, I think it starts with the fact that, you know, in our culture, at least, UFOs are associated with aliens. And one of the oldest questions that humans have had, although I haven't talked to all of the oldest humans, but, you know, are we alone? What else is going on in the universe? And UFOs are kind of a way from Earth, on Earth, that we can think about that question, which we don't get a lot of opportunities to do. I think also, you know, a lot of people, probably most people, have seen something in the sky and not known what it was. And, like, that's a weird feeling. Like, I've seen plenty of things. I don't know what they were. I don't think that they were aliens, but, it, you know, it's cool and interesting to look up at the sky and see something weird. But kind of the overarching sentiment that seemed to unite all of the people who I spoke to is just, like, there aren't a whole lot of huge mysteries left in the world. And, you know, what is a UFO is one. And it's a fascinating problem. I think one of the NASA officials, you know, said it's one of the most fascinating questions or most important questions out there. And, you know, humans have spent decades and decades at least trying to get some answers, and we haven't yet. And so You know, at least for me working on the book, when I started, I was like, oh, maybe I could be the person who figures it out. And of course I wasn't. And usually no one is, but that everybody likes a mystery. Everybody likes to investigate. And when you have a mystery that relates to one of humanity's deepest and oldest questions, like that's kind of the jackpot, I think.
What's ahead, Sarah? What do you think is next in kind of our understanding of this and the community's reaction to what is going on at places like the DOD and NASA as they investigate these UAP?
Yeah, I wish I had a crystal ball, so that I don't. So this will just be a guess. But, you know, I think as the stigma that we talked about starts to decrease and we do have more of these official investigation programs, we'll both get more reports that are verifiable from both from civilians and from military personnel that can be investigated. And that is, you know, data. And then NASA is looking at its own data to understand kind of the context around all of that. And so I think for a while, we probably won't have a ton of answers. But as you, just as you start to have more information, you can start to kind of pin down answers about what's going on. And to me, something that's fascinating and often I think it's lost in UFO conversations is that UFOs have never been just one thing. We talk about them like, you know, they're all flying saucers or they're all military drones or something, but they're tons and tons of things. Even if some of them are extraordinary, some of them are balloons, some of them are Venus. You know, some of them might be something we don't truly understand. And so kind of understanding the scope of that in a bigger and more official way. And I think I kind of think the reactions will probably be similar to what they are now, either just, you know, gratefulness that somebody's taking it seriously or skepticism that we're getting the whole story. That's kind of been the story of UFOs since the beginning of UFOs.
Sarah Scholes is a science journalist, and her book is They Are Already Here, UFO Culture and Why We See Saucers. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or really wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit wmfe.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Alessandro Bonaiuto. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.